This is Tom Salami of Device Talks. We're excited to bring you another great program for Device Talks West here at the Santa Clara Convention Center, talking new business models, new missions, and new intentions. I can't wait until we fill this auditorium with MedTech's best engineers, entrepreneurs, and executives. This is Device Talks West.
The foundation of connected care is the who we are that drives the what we do. We shape our environment, and then our environment shapes us.
Thoughtful discussions of how it impacts not only markets, but society and the workforce.
What is it doing for the patient? And that's what our technology needs to be.
I look at what the standard of care is today. Are there areas where we can improve upon the standard of care, or are there areas where there are significant gaps? And that's what drives me.
What am I trying to accomplish? You know, getting back to that core, what problem am I trying to solve? Am I going to do something new and really move the needle for patient outcomes? So there's a ton of work to be done, and that's what keeps me excited.
Why did you choose MedTech? Find out at Device Talks West on October 16th and 17th. Register at west.devicetalks.com.
The folks that are saving lives, they're all here.
Hey everyone, this is Tom Salami. Welcome to the Device Talks Weekly Podcast. Sorry about the little fake out there with the Device Talks West ad, but I like it. I think it's cool. I like the music. And talked to lots of great people there, and we're getting excited. We have Device Talks West coming up in, just under 2 months. And we'd love to have you there. So we have created the discount code. Use the code DTPOD25, and that'll save you 25% off the price of registration. That's how badly we want you there, because it's going to be a fantastic couple of days. We've got conversations locked in with Abbott, Boston Scientific, Baxter, Medtronic, Stryker, and more, and more and more. Phillips is coming. I'll mention someone at the end of the podcast. We just locked in literally 2 hours ago from my recording this. So it's going to be a fantastic opportunity for you to build your brand, to build your MedTech network, to learn from some of the leaders and experts in the space. So certainly make yourselves available for Device Talks West. Again, it's happening October 16th and 17th at the Santa Clara Convention Center. We've got a great episode for you today. Of course, we'll have Chris Newmarker and his Newmarker's Newsmakers a little later in the program, right after the intro music sounds, a normal place for that. And then after that, I spoke with Tasneem Dohodwala. She is the founding partner of Accelistar Ventures. And I love talking to VCs, obviously. I think that's evident from past interviews. Really enjoyed this conversation with Tasneem, talking about her, the way she looks at deals, the way she analyzes deals, the system she has for evaluating deals, how she built an analytical system to either confirm or steer her away from, you know, what her gut is telling her. Obviously, VCs look at all kinds of data, but I really enjoyed the way she walked me through the process to help me understand how Accelistar is making investments. It's a smaller fund in the Boston area, but it's making some great investments. It's a reasonable size fund for an early stage fund, and really just enjoyed her perspective. So enjoyed her talking about the formula she's using to make investments, but also really got into a great conversation with her about how she really weighs who is on the management team, who is in the leadership team, and why she believes that a team that represents the broader population of the medtech industry is the better team to invest in. So we'll talk about that as well. So again, thank you to Tasneem Dohodwala for joining us on the podcast. I think you'll enjoy that conversation. Final thing, before we begin the conversation, please join us on Tuesdays. We've got our fall season of Device Talks Tuesdays is starting up. We'll be talking with the fine folks at Bay Cable about the top five things to shop for in your custom cable and assembly supplier. So we'll be talking on Tuesday at 4 p.m. You, of course, can watch live. We'd love to have you there live, but you're also able to watch at your convenience on demand. Just register and you can watch whenever it works for you. But watch live and you'll have the opportunity to ask questions and get answers immediately. And that's always fun. So, all right, folks, let's get this podcast episode started. All right, you ready for this?
Ready.
Sir,
doing well, Tom. Doing well.
So, have you hit the fair yet? Have you gotten your unlimited $3 milk?
Fair has not started yet, but we'll be.
Oh, yeah. All right. I thought it was an August thing. It's not kicked in yet.
It's kicking in, and just oh my gosh, it's. Well, you know, Tom. Actually, today we are talking on Thursday, August 22nd. Today is the first day of the Minnesota State Fair.
Woohoo! Happy Fair Day, everybody.
Got the fair going. That's great. Lasting through Labor Day, so I think we'll be getting over there Labor Day weekend.
I'm sure it won't be crowded.
It depends. It depends. Like
on Labor Day, I was joking. Labor Day weekend, I'm guessing there'll be a few people there.
I think no matter what, Labor Day weekend it'll be pretty crowded. So, but it'll be very fun cool, time. Very cool. Good times.
So I took the trip out to Purdue, dropped the awesome. Sophomore Boilermaker off, stopped in Rochester, New York, which is always a favorite stop.
Oh, it's nice.
A nice little town there.
Yeah.
And we stopped in Fort Wayne, Indiana, and saw the Fort Wayne Tin Caps, which was this high single-A team in the San Diego Padres organization. And it was a lovely ballpark. It
That's
was designed
fantastic.
By the same group that designed Camden Yards. So it was quite fancy
for a
single A ballpark. So if you're ever in the Fort Wayne area, I highly recommend taking in a Tin Caps game.
Growing up north of Columbus, I made it over to Fort Wayne, a few times. Like it's a good city. It's a good little city. So
one of the most affordable in the U.S. apparently.
Probably not too far from Warsaw, where Simmer Biomet's based.
No, you're absolutely right.
Yeah.
Not far from all at all from the orthopedics capital of the world, where Zimmer Biomet and DePue is also, I believe, located there as well as others. So I think it's about 40 or 45 minutes.
Maybe you'll have to do a little, like sometime when you're, when you're taking your son out there to Purdue, you'll have to do a little visit over to Warsaw.
We did. We did two summers ago.
Oh, that's right.
Pulled through Warsaw. Yeah, no, I couldn't drive by.
Can't do that.
Warsaw, although it was about 40 minutes off the highway, so it wasn't an immediate kind of like off turn. You're right there. But it was totally worth it. Worth driving around, seeing all the headquarters, getting a cup of coffee, just chilling out.
Yeah.
Getting a sense of everything. In fact, I talked a great deal about Warsaw in this week's Ortho Innovation Talks podcast. I spoke with Jim Lancaster of Zimmer Biomet, who's the head of Recon, but is also the executive director of the Zimmer Biomet headquarters, Chris. And this might get your dander up a bit, but they're working to build themselves beyond the orthopedics capital of the world. They want to be a medtech capital of the world, and they're coming at you, Minnesota. The Warsaw wants a piece of you.
They're going for the Twin Cities. I mean,
yep.
Good for them. This is like,
listen to this guy. He's feeling a bit sure of himself. Did you hear that, Warsaw?
I mean the Minneapolis. That's cool. I mean, it's actually really amazing how like you actually see that you have California, Massachusetts, Minnesota. You know, these three big hubs, and you know Indiana needs some respect. I mean, they're especially with orthopedics, but it's Cook Medical's there as well in Bloomington, and
they got the plug and play in there now in Warsaw. They're starting to incubate companies. So Device Talks Warsaw, we can be seeing that in a couple of years. Who knows?
There we go. Yeah, Device Talks. Device Talks, call it Device Talks. Well, Device Talks Warsaw, they might think we're in Poland. So you might,
that could be too.
Yeah. Device Talks Poland.
Probably further down the line.
We'll split some pierogies, Tom.
I would like Device Talks Ireland, Device Talks Galway, incrementally across the European
continent. We'll start with the you know, with some bangers and mash at, you know, Device Talks Galway and move on eventually the pierogies at Device Talks Poland. So.
Oh, I love planning our empires together, Christine Walker.
What country, next country we'll go to?
Costa Rica. January.
Oh, there you go.
We'll definitely have Device Talks Costa Rica. We got to work on that one.
Sounds great. Yeah. We'll do some zip lining. Big good times. Yeah.
Big plans. All right, Christine Walker. This is people, we shouldn't reveal our secret plans to folks on a podcast. It's not good business practice. So,
Tom, why are you releasing our secret plans?
Forget everything we've just said.
Let's forget what we were saying. Okay. All right. So,
What is number five on your vaunted Newmarket's Newsmakers list, Chris?
Number five on the list. This was really interesting. You know, we've already reported, you know, Dr. Jeff Schurant, he's, you know, he's going to be, you know, stepping down as head of CDRH after, you know, 15 years. And he's already, you know, stepped down, retired from the director's post. And he's right now just, you know, serving as kind of like a director emeritus at the FDA until, you know, later in this year to help with the transition. But, he got a big there was a big feature story about him in the New York Times, and it wasn't great.
No, it was not. I mean, once you saw it was a large article in the New York Times, you knew it wasn't going to be great. And I think the article raised some good points in that he seemed to involve himself in some business that the firm in which his wife is employed was representing the companies. Although the evidence of that seemed to be somewhat circumstantial. I mean, some texts and things like that. I mean, it wasn't anything. There was no mention ever of this happened. At least I can't recall of something saying he did this and this and this. It was just more inference that he was involved in things.
It was more that like they had a few, you know, cases and, you know, and they, you know, they based this off of, you know, by the way, I've got a nice, you know, summary of on, you know, Mass Device, you know, FDA Schurant faces ethics questions in an NYT report. But, you know, I mean, they, you know, the New York Times said they reviewed thousands of pages of, you know, court documents and FDA records and conducted dozens of interviews. And they found several cases and instances where, you know, Jeff Schurant's job intersected in some way with his wife says, you know, being, you know, his wife being a you know, Alison Schurant being a, you know, a prominent life sciences lawyer, you know, for Arnold and Porter. But yeah, it didn't, I mean, it wasn't like anything of like, oh, here's, you know, Jeff going to do something for his wife. It's more just, you know, that, you know, he, you know, I think there'd be an expectation that he recused himself from something that was related to her law firm. But I mean, yeah, it wasn't anything, you know, and the FDA, in a statement that they shared with the New York Times, in which they also shared with Mass Device, you know, they were saying that yes, they're, you know, they acknowledged that there were some instances from maybe about 10 years ago when he should have either recused himself or sought ethics authorization. But at the same time, they said there was like no indication that he made any decisions that was in the interest of any parties other than the public that the FDA is supposed to serve. And they said no indications that he violated any criminal conflict of interest statute, you know, so... you know, he's, you know, they're, you know, continuing to talk about like how, like that they're proud of the work he's done at the FDA over the past 15 years.
Yeah. I'm obviously a journalist and I fully support, harsh looks at our industry. And I think there are instances where you should have been more careful with what happened. And I don't think the evidence that was that this investigation resulted in was compelling or overly compelling in any way. Yeah. Did nothing really raise an eyebrow, but I guess and this is where the kind of the Homer part of me kind of kicks in. It's like, I've never seen an article about the good that medical devices do or, you know, just some of the really positive things that come from this industry. As I alluded to at the start, it's like, as soon as you see them writing about the device industry, it tends to be a kick in the ribs as opposed to, hey, look at this novel technology that's saving lives. So I guess a little positivity would be great.
Yeah.
That's kind of off topic here.
I mean, it is really, I mean, yeah, there's been criticism of Shuren, you know, saying that the FDA became too, you know, from like patient advocates, you know, saying the FDA became too industry friendly, you know, during his tenure. But on the flip side, I mean, gosh, when I started covering this industry, you know, over a decade ago, yeah, I mean, you still saw stuff getting approved in Europe first, and then eventually down the road, it got approved here. And, you know, now it's the opposite case. We're always writing about stuff getting approved here first in the US. And, I think that's a pretty cool accomplishment. Now we just got to make sure that, you know, we're still upholding our standards as, you know, the time goes along.
Absolutely. Yeah. But, no, absolutely. And obviously patients should come first. And you're right. And I remember an article, and I don't know if it was the New York Times, I don't know who wrote it, but there's an article about how Americans were going to Europe to have procedures done because they weren't available here. You know, that's not a good outcome either. So I hear what you're saying, and I know they pointed to the sort of the number of approvals of what had gone on a decade ago to what's going on now. Is like, I forget the exact numbers, but there's multiples of approvals now compared to 10 years ago. But it was kind of, the fact was submitted as kind of a evidence that industry was being treated too kindly.
Yeah.
But I turn it around and say, no, a lot of life-saving devices have been approved and have helped patients, and we're seeing and hearing stories all the time of how they're helping. So, yes, I think you should have been more careful. Yes, I think good objective reporting like this is welcome and necessary.
We need watchdogs, and, you know, watchdog journalism, you know, like our public officials doing the right thing.
Absolutely.
But, you know, at the same time, like even us, when you do journalism, you know, you're kind of framing this based on your point of view in the world. And, you know, I know when I do that kind of journalism, I try to be really open with myself about where I'm coming from, you know, and ask myself a lot, am I being fair about this?
I'm glad the New York Times is there. I'm glad they do what they do.
Totally.
They think the article was worth writing, but I don't think it was anything really overly concerning or revelatory. And, you know, maybe they could write a nice article once in a while.
Should be. That's right. Come on. Give us a break. But no, definitely, we you know, we had something on Mass Device about it because it's the New York Times, the front page story on the, you know, front, or home, I don't know if it was on the front page, but home page story, you know, about this top official that we've, you know, known for many years now, like, you know, as we cover the industry. Yeah.
All right.
We're done.
Good stuff. Let's move on to
number four. There's only so much grousing we can do, Tom. There's only so much.
Get off my lawn. Daggummit.
Oh, anyway.
What's number four on your award-winning Newmarker's Newsmakers
next
list,
on the list? We've got Medtronic first quarter earnings report. They had what analysts described as a modest, you know, beat, you know, of analyst expectations. They upped the lower end of their revenue guidance for the year, and the markets were, you know, pretty positive about it. I mean, I think last time I checked, their stock is up 4%. For the week. So, not bad. I mean, considering that, you know, Medtronic has had a lot of challenges in recent years, major reorganization, major operational stuff, you know, that they're, you know, the fact that they can boost their earnings more than what was expected and, you know, kind of up their guidance. I mean, it sounds good. Like, let's hope we get more news like that.
Absolutely. And I'm looking at the article now, and the article was written by you, Chris.
Yes, it was.
And you cited the work that Medtronic, the diabetes rebound, which we talked about a few weeks ago at least we talked about their partnership with
Abbott
a few
weeks
ago.
Played a big role, revenue up, you know, nearly 12% year over year.
Yep. And you mentioned also Simplicity Spiral, the rental innovation system. And that's having a boost as well. And
or at least, I don't know, it's not really boosting them now, but there's definitely a lot of hope that it's definitely being presented as something that down the road could be like a big growth driver for them. And they're definitely working a lot on, you know, getting, you know, some kind of reimbursements, you know, lined up for it. I mean, and, you know, and hypertension is like a huge chronic disease problem, you know, in this country and the world. So anything that you could, you know, get out there to make it easier to treat it would be great. And, you know, there's so many complications around it.
And then I think it was reported that as of October of this year, Medicare will provide additional payments.
Yeah, and you know, it's also worth noting they already are getting included in this new technology add-on payment program that the CMS just recently finalized. Which, I mean, that's a big deal for the industry because I mean, that was kind of like rolled back that kind of idea that if you had this breakthrough device designation that you could, this would like help fast track you with getting reimbursement, with CMS programs like Medicare. Like now that's back and the renal denervation systems for Medtronic and Recore Medical are among those that like stand to benefit from it.
Absolutely. All right. And we'll, of course, plug here. We'll have Jason Weidman, the Senior Vice President of Coronary and Renal Innervation at Medtronic, speaking at Device Talks West. So register for that at west.devicetalks.com.
Yeah, and you know, it also stuck out to me that Jeff Martha, their Medtronic CEO, said they're sticking with Hugo. So, you know, they're staying at it. And there was another interesting thing that I heard that, you know, it's not in the article, but when they were asking about, you know, where the company is now, basically. I mean, he was saying they had all these operational changes they've had, all this reorganization and, you know, and some layoffs as well. He was kind of saying that they're kind of moving past that at this point. And he kind of hinted we might see some, you know, them uptick some tuck-in M&A, you know, going forward. I mean, there wasn't really any, I don't recall like hearing a timetable about it, but you know, we could start seeing some more M&A deals, which then kind of like leads into the rest of the newsmakers that we have today.
Well, that's interesting news because it's been a while, I think, since we've seen Medtronic acquire a company, and be nice to get them back into the game.
You know, there was some excitement last year that they might acquire a wearable insulin patch maker, EOFlow, and that was going to be like a, you know, over $700 million deal, but that fell through. So yeah, we'll see. Hopefully we'll see if we'll get some more deals coming like around Medtronic. As I recall, Affera was probably the last big deal that they did.
Okay.
Let's move on. You know, so that kind of just moves on. I mean, my gosh, a lot of M&A news this week. There are a number of major companies on an M&A tear right now. I mean, just first off, just to mention it, Zoll, based in Massachusetts, they acquired Vyer Medical's ventilator business out of Chapter 11 bankruptcy proceedings. And that's just kind of interesting just because, I mean, gosh, I mean, Vyer, you know, they had a lot of business, you know, during the height of the pandemic, but now here we are, you know, it's Chapter 11 and their ventilator business is getting acquired by Zoll. So we had that news, but then, you know, kind of moving on more to like what these big companies are doing that are on a tear. I mean, gosh, we've got Stryker. You know, we're talking on Thursday just today. They announced they were, acquiring Vertos Medical. So this is like this, you know, tuck-in deal for this company with a, with kind of like a surgical technology to, you know, it's minimally invasive to treat chronic lower back pain. So that's interesting. And my gosh, you know, Kevin Lobo, their CEO over at Stryker, has been saying that they're on offense right now with M&A. So, I mean, this is, I think, the second just this month alone for them. And we'll keep on following this. I think we're going to have a lot more deals to follow from Stryker going forward.
Absolutely. Now, as I said on LinkedIn, this doesn't seem to be the deal that we're all waiting for, a big deal, a big seismic deal. But Stryker's definitely building out its toolbox and its spine. And it'll be interesting to see what happens once Mako is sort of directed toward spinal surgery, what impact that has on Stryker's spinal business. So,
I mean, it's been a big deal for Medtronic with Mazor, you know, in the spinal space. So yeah, having Stryker come in with Mako, that'll be really interesting to watch. It's great to see competition.
All right, what other deals have you been reporting on?
I'll deal you some more. We got got some more deals here. We got Edwards acquiring TAVR maker JC Medical from its parent company, Genesis MedTech. So that's just, I mean, Edwards, my gosh, we've been covering so many deals from them recently, including like them spending like their plans to spend $1.2 billion on Genovalve and Endotronics. But here we got them acquiring J-Valve. So they're just, you know, they got a nice, and we've talked about how they're getting a nice little infusion of cash from selling the critical care business to BD, and the acquisitions continue.
Absolutely. I mean, we, of course, if you're a subscriber to the Device Talks Podcast Network, last week you received the first episode of the Structural Heart Talks podcast that we're doing in cooperation with Edwards Life Sciences. So make sure you subscribe to this podcast network so you can get future episodes of this fantastic podcast, but also Structural Heart Talks. You'll hear more from Edwards executives about their plans for the future.
Yeah, that's fantastic. So if you want to get a hint of, you know, where they might do some M&A next, yeah, that sounds like a place to go.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And then the final newsmaker, Kristen
number
Marshall.
One on the list. We've got Johnson & Johnson. They're spending $1.7 billion to buy heart failure treatment maker V-Wave. And V-Wave has this technology. It's called an interatrial shunt. And this is like implanted through a minimally invasive procedure. It's like it got a nitinol hourglass frame. Nitinol is just like this.
Nitinol!
It's a hot material, I think. You know, when we're at Device Talks West, our MDO managing editor, Jim Hammerhand, so excited about nitinol. I might not call over Jim when I need help from him for something. I just go like, nitinol. He'll just look over. It'll be awesome. I think, but, and, you know, and we actually have, you know, a new nitinol newsletter that is rolling out on medical design outsourcing. So subscribe to that, you know, to find out even more news about nitinol. But this has a nitinol hourglass frame. And, you know, the idea is it decreases elevated left atrial pressure that, you know, you see in congestive heart failure. And they kind of see this, you know, J&J kind of sees this, you know, what they call like a first of its kind tech to hit the market as a, you know, as something that's kind of like in between the first line therapies and then like these really, you know, really serious therapies like, you know, getting an LVAD implanted or, you know, or even getting a heart transplant. So this might be, you know, something in between those two that, you know, there could be, you know, could be a real need for. So it's filling a treatment gap.
Absolutely. And if I may amend your very first statement where you said J&J is paying $1.7 billion, they could pay up to.
Oh, yes. Thank you.
The upfront is $600
million. $600
million. Which,
it could get up to, depending on milestones, to $1.7 billion.
Milestones and earnouts, which are always very, very, very difficult to make them all. But for a company that raised roughly, from my account anyway, from counting press releases, $200 million, yeah, a nice 3X guaranteed return for investors, but could get up to 5, 6, or 7X depending upon the earnout. Yeah. So. Nice little story. I wouldn't want to say end of the story, but nice conclusion to an investment into V-Valve.
I know both of us. I mean, all the entrepreneurs we've talked to over the years. I mean, it's tough going building a medical device company, and it takes a long time to get to that exit point. So, I mean, it's always like really, you know, I think it feels really good for the people in that MedTech entrepreneurial community to see like an exit like that for a company.
All right. Well, great job as always. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Tom. Catch you soon.
Well, thanks again to Chris Newmarker for this week's Newsmakers. Now we're going to have a bit of a new feature for Device Talks Weekly. Over the coming weeks and perhaps beyond that, we'll be giving firms the opportunity to highlight themselves with just short messages. So I'm happy to have as our first firm, Kwame Ulmer. He's Managing Director of MedTech Impact Partners. And Kwame, who has been on the podcast previously, will talk about some news at the FDA. So we'll have MedTech Impact Partners message today, and we'll have a part two in a later episode. So enjoy this brief message from MedTech Impact Partners.
Welcome to Regulatory Insights, where we cover regulatory issues important to medtech companies in just a few minutes. Today, we'll explore the FDA's Breakthrough Devices Designation Program in part one of a two-part series. In the second part, we'll evaluate the Total Product Lifecycle Advisory Program, or TAP. Both are aimed to accelerate innovative medical devices' time to market. We'll cover the benefits and challenges for both, helping you determine if such a program is worth your investment. Let's explore. In 2023, we observed a notable surge in the number of breakthrough designations compared to prior years, underscoring the FDA's dedication to make best efforts to accelerate the approval processes for these technologies. This program aims to expedite FDA's reviews and also encourages early collaboration, mitigating the risks of costly delays and increasing market and investor interest. However, breakthrough devices also face limitations compared to an earlier policy called MCIT, CMS's Transitional Coverage for Emerging Technology Proposal, or TCIT, will limit reimbursement to only 5 devices per year. This means evaluating the trade-off between applying and participating versus likelihood of being selected in that group of 5. So what are the key questions? 1, is the brand value from being designated breakthrough enough? 2, will my 510K device really have a shorter review time? 3, do investors and other key stakeholders think this program is important? 4, what are my realistic chances of being part of the group of 5 devices selected? For an in-depth analysis, visit medtechimpactpartners.com. I'm Kwame Ulmer with MedTech Impact Partners, and this was Regulatory Insights.
That's great. And as I said, we'll have more messaging coming from you in coming episodes. A lot of them will be our fantastic sponsors from Device Talks West. We're really excited to have their support and excited to help them tell their stories on the Device Talks weekly podcast. Now, let's get into my keynote conversation. Once again, I'm speaking with Tasneem Dhodwala. She is founding partner of Accelerstar Ventures.
Well, Tasneem Dhodwala, welcome to the podcast.
Well, thanks, Tom, for having me. I'm excited to be here.
It's always great to visit with a venture capitalist. I think you folks just lead such exciting lives of mystery and wonder. So it'd be great to hear what's going on at Accelerstar.
Of course.
First, of course, we'd love to find out about backgrounds and how folks found their way into their jobs, into the medical mm-hmm. device industry. What was it that, let's go way back, because I don't think your first inclination was the medical device industry. Was it you were directed more at finance?
Yeah. So actually, I would say that I found my way into finance through a process of elimination of all the things I didn't want to do, which normally most people probably don't admit to. But I think, you know, you decide all the things that you don't want to do, and then you kind of figure out what's left, and then you go for that. And I went to Wellesley. I was Wellesley College. I was I loved it there, and I was completely undecided and found my way into the financial world. Actually, before even joining Lehman, I'd looked at lots of different aspects of finance, and mm-hmm. the sales meeting at Lehman Brothers was the best fit for me, and I absolutely loved it. For me, I think the environment, I know that it's not for everybody, but for me, it was perfect, especially as someone young and excited to be out there. It was fast-paced and dynamic, and I was actually very lucky. There were very few women on the trading floor, but my desk, the managing director, was a female. And so amazing mentorship and, camaraderie with her. And so I feel blessed because that was not the norm.
What careers did you rule out? I'm just curious. Were you like, look, I don't like blood, so I'm not going to be a doctor, and I don't like heights, so I'm not going to be, what had you gone through?
Family, I still come from a family of physicians.
Okay.
I mean, you throw a stone and there's a physician in our family, and and they're all amazing people. And I interned at my mom's clinic when I was right before I started college, and I realized That was definitely not for me. so we won't go into the gory details of why. I was pretty sure I didn't want to be an attorney. Engineering didn't sound that exciting for me. And I even considered being a college professor at some point and doing a PhD to get there. And then I realized that's probably not the path for me. But, you know, every so often, I still wonder if I should go and be a college professor, because there's something about that. I spend a lot of time in the education space volunteering, and I do love all the institutions that I was privileged to go to. So you never know, maybe another career someday.
Absolutely. It's nice to influence young people. So you were at Lehman's, and the date was interesting. You were at Lehman's in 2006, right? Mm-hmm. Right around there.
Yep. So. And I left right before I was actually in Harvard. I was at Harvard Business School when Lehman Brothers collapsed.
Wow.
So we were literally watching it, like a business case unfold. And I think it was for a lot of people. I mean, there were a lot of people from the banking industry. And so we were hearing from colleagues that were in it and not in business school with us. And it was heartbreaking. And yet fascinating to see what was happening and to be on the sort of educational, the student side of it during that time. But it was really hard to see what was happening to the bank, because despite what other people may think of the bank, I had an amazing experience there. I felt like I grew up there as a finance professional, and it's still a really important piece of who I am and who I've become as a you know, venture capitalist. So I'm very thankful for my experience there.
No, I can believe that. I mean, it was like Coca-Cola. I mean, it's just one of those names that you just assumed would be there forever, or the big tree in your backyard. Yep. So you had gone, you did the Wall Street thing. You were going to business school. Was this just to sort of build a foundation? And if so, what were you building a foundation toward? Had you sort of figured out?
Yeah. So I had an amazing educational experience at Wellesley, but obviously Wellesley is a liberal arts college. And so I was able to I was very intellectually curious. I learned about lots of different things, and I learned a lot being at Lehman. I'm not sure there's any sort of educational experience that can prepare you for the real world. And, but I was well prepared as a learner. And then when I realized I wanted to I always wanted to go to business school. I always knew that was in the plan. What I didn't know was, what was I going to do after business school? And so I really went to business school, just like Wellesley, with a really open mind about what I wanted to pursue after. And entrepreneurship, really fascinated me. And just like medicine is in my blood, there's entrepreneurial genes in the blood too. So I knew that entrepreneurship fascinated me. And I tried both sides of the coin. I worked in a portfolio company as well as I worked at Matrix Partners. Mm-hmm. And I realized that the venture side was much more fascinating to me than, at that time, at least, the portfolio company side. Mm-hmm. And there's nuances, right? I think when you're in a portfolio company, you are doing whatever you're working on, your opportunity, you are doing that day in and day out. Mm-hmm. But you're on the playing field. You're a player in the game. You are impacting the trajectory of that company dynamically through your own work. And as a venture capitalist, you're very much a coach on the sidelines. And while the win is still really satisfying and exciting, you're still a coach. Yeah. You're not in the game. And if you need to be a coach that's in the game, I would say the game's not going very well.
That's a good point. Yeah.
That was a nuance that I kind of teased out early days during business school, as well as after business school, talking to my classmates and talking to professors and being in classes, work experience. And I realized that the fun side was definitely, and I kind of tied better to my financial roots that I had sort of grown up in. And so business school solidified that I wanted to be on the fun side.
Do you think, I hadn't really thought about this until you just started talking about your family, but do you think there's a common wiring between physicians, good physicians, and entrepreneurs? I mean, you're both in control. You're both just in the thick of it. Your sleeves are rolled up. Do you find that? Yeah.
I do think so. I think being a physician, so the similarities between the two is they're striving for excellence, both. Number one. Number two, I think they both have to be very creative, because even though physicians have specific protocols, they have to be creative, and there's a real personal touch to both fields. I mean, you have to be a people person if you're an entrepreneur. You have to be a people person, a successful entrepreneur, between funding, managing your investors, managing people on your team, talking to customers. And physicians, obviously, they have to be people people. And I think you have to also be constant learners. I think if you're an entrepreneur, you need to be constantly surveying the market, understanding what are the market needs, and adjusting, rapid prototyping. I mean, there's just so much learning in innovation, or bringing innovation to fruition. And as a physician, you're doing that constant learning as well. So there I think it's so many similarities.
That's a great observation. So let's talk, and I think I might have misspoke earlier, about the firm. Is it Accelestar? I think I said Accelestar.
It's Accelestar Ventures, yeah.
So you started that in 2010. You had the time at Matrix Partners at that point. You done some work at a portfolio company? It seems like for a young person out of business school to move into a venture firm is kind of like someone graduating from culinary school and deciding to open their own five-star restaurant. It's like we're going right to the deep end. What was that process like? And am I mischaracterizing it? Because
no, you're really not. We started small, and we started just with a few high net worth individuals. I think for people that wanted to be part of a small fund, and investors that wanted to sort of really have more control over their assets in a small fund, we were lucky that sort of fit their bill. And I also think during that time, as you may remember, the capital markets were a bit of a disarray.
Yes.
And so people were pulling money out of their capital markets, and your traditional funds were struggling, and many were actually closing. And so we had a really nice opportunity to capture a few high net worth individuals and capture a small fund. And I think the benefit of having a small fund is you actually have quite a bit of flexibility in how much you can put into a deal, how many deals you, I mean, a lot of times large funds, they have to put a certain amount to play every single year.
Sure.
And they can't get into a small round of, you know, $10 million because they really need to put a lot more money to work. And if you're, you know, trying to go in early to deals, it sort of changes the dynamic. And the fund has grown over time, and it is an evergreen fund. So they just kept on putting money into it after we had exits, which we're really lucky to have that. And it has, it's doing well.
Lucky you're good. We'll say you're skilled in identifying those exits. So what though is the pitch or the angle that you as a new venture capitalist, or small is great, and you're right for all the reasons you stated, but I think there has to be more because a lot of people can start small funds. Did you come up with some sort of, we want to invest in specific company more than by industry, but you were looking for a certain type of something? What was kind of your angle?
I mean, bluntly, we didn't have a great pitch in the beginning.
Okay.
I mean, I'm being really honest. I think that we wanted to do a lot of different things. Mm-hmm. And I would say that we have become much more focused on what we're doing now than we were when I first started. When we first started, I kind of very bluntly kind of was focused on investing in spaces that the investors were interested in investing in.
Mm-hmm.
And over time, like, for example, we started investing in what back then was called clean tech or green energy, and now it's called climate tech. I mean, it's gone through renewable, whatever. And we dropped that within a couple of years of starting the fund. We realized that doing that was a space in itself, and within that space, there were so many spaces, and that was not really for us. And the other thing we realized was that therapeutics was really not our thing. We didn't really invest in therapeutics, but we never found a therapeutic company that really fit the bill properly. So we didn't invest in therapeutics even early on. We did do a diagnostics investment, and we realized that also is not for us. And so we sort of cut diagnostics out as well. So I think I actually learned a lot, and I have refined our thesis.
Mm-hmm.
our investment thesis quite a bit. So on the medtech side, we're pretty clear that we're investing in something that's actually delivering the therapy. We're not investing in aids or instrumentation. We're not investing in diagnostics. And we have a really pretty robust diligence process that we follow. And that has also been honed and much more sort of refined over the years. And I feel really good about where we're at now with our diligence. I feel like it's very applicable to all the deals that we do. It allows us to come to what I believe are strong decisions in our opportunities that we're looking at. It also, there are some, we've created ways that we're able to go through the deals much quicker than we were before, and able to really hone down on the issues that we want to unravel to learn more about the company. And frankly, we can get to an answer also quicker than we used to be able to because of a more sort of disciplined diligence process.
So is it more the process than you're just able to talk to someone and sort of glean what you need to glean more quickly? Or do you have, like, without sharing your state secrets, do you have like a certain filing you can find or some kind of piece of information that kind of gives you a red light or a green light? Like, what, how has your process evolved over that time?
So first of all, we have the whole qualitative process, which is probably very typical to a lot of, you know, VC investors. Actually, I would say it's not typical because we actually get really deep. We spend a lot of time. The first part of the diligence is spending time with the company as well as any primary sources. So most of the cases, it's physicians that would be using the device. And also with physicians, it's not just the ones that are connected with the company, but independent physicians. And we always take it with a grain of salt because a lot of times physicians that are not connected to the company are skeptical. And they keep saying, well, if the data comes out and if you get clearance and if it's safe and, you know, if it's not toxic and whatever it may be, you have to push beyond that. But you also have to understand that they are seeing what they're seeing right now in the market. And I think what you spend really time on is trying to understand whatever problem you're trying to solve. Do they really believe that's a problem? Do they really feel like that's a pain point for them? Do they really want to treat that condition better than what's being treated right now? And that's what we're trying to glean from our primary reference, because a lot of times physicians may not like the idea in the beginning, but if they can articulate that whatever you're saying is the pain point, truly is a pain point, then I think you've sort of validated that there's an opportunity in the market. Then it's your responsibility as a company to be actually able to build a product that addresses the pain point. And then you bring in other people to help you due diligence. Can the company actually build what they're saying they can build? Which we do that as well. So that's sort of the first phase. And what I would say comes from that, our own independent market research, a qualitative report. But also what I realized with the qualitative report, and this sort of goes to our focus and our desire to invest in female founders as well as underrepresented founders, we created a more objective way of measuring companies. Because a lot of times I would sort of get a gut read on a company, but I will follow my gut and my instinct, but I always like to have evidence about why do I feel a certain way around my gut? You know, what is it about that gut instinct? I wanted to sort of rationalize it a little bit. So just didn't feel like I was making a decision on gut. And I also feel like your gut is super biased. And so I wanted to cut that bias or try to eliminate bias in my decision making, especially if it was a new market or a new entrepreneur that I wasn't as familiar with. And I wanted to be able to sort of figure out try to parse that out a little bit. So we have an objective matrix. We look at 6 to 8 factors in that objective matrix. We're always sort of, you know, finalizing as like a rubric, and it has certain parameters, something like market and investment risk and team and whatever it may be. And then we rank it. And the ranking is -2 to 2. And if you get a certain score, you're investable. And if you get, you know, you don't make the threshold, then I wouldn't say that cuts you completely out of the deal, but it really makes me think, why are you getting that score? And do I need to, and we do this even for our follow-ons, especially if it's a larger investment and we've been in the deal for a while, we always sort of go through this, this discipline of ranking our companies. And it's been interesting because now that we have been doing it for a while, we actually compare one ranking to another ranking. So like if I have a really stellar company that I'm feeling really excited about, I will go back and look at their diligence ranking and compare it to a new company to see, you know, this one came at an 8 and wow, this one's coming at a 10. Why am I still feeling so concerned about that new company at a 10? And it's actually really interesting data points.
It really
and it helps me create objective reasons. I have to work very hard to figure out, why am I giving it a 1? Why am I giving it a 2? Why is it 0 at neutral? And it makes me think. And the principal at Excelistar, Emily, who works with me, she does her own ranking. And then we come together and compare our rankings. And we don't do it together. We try not to do it together. So that way we have 2 data points to compare with. And of course, that parlays back with the qualitative report. And then we present all of that to our investor-based investment committee, and then we justify our decision. But specifically in diligence, besides, you know, what I said around primary research, we look at the market size is a really big deal for us, because the amount of money that's going to go into some of these med device companies, the market needs to be able to support that type of investment, i.e. that final acquisition price.
Sure.
The market is a big deal for us. And really making sure that the problem that is being addressed is a problem, and that the technology is being developed to solve the problem. Not, wow, this is really cool technology, let me go find a home for it. You know, let me go see what it can solve. That never works. It has to start, the genesis has to start with the problem, the clinical problem. And then we also think that if you have a large market size and you've identified a compelling clinical problem with a novel solution to address the problem, we really believe that's an indicator of a really strong team. Mm-hmm. So because your sort of B or C teams sometimes don't pick the biggest markets, or they have a technology and they're looking for a problem to solve with.
Right, right.
Those are 2 really easy ways of sort of identifying the strength of the team and the expertise of the team and the experience of the team. And if you put all that together, you can have a really robust evaluation of the company.
That's really fascinating. I want to get into your support for underrepresented executives in a moment, but I want to unpack 2 parts of what you just said. First, the whole the matrix versus your gut. What's your gut's batting average? Are they usually in line, 50-50? You know, your gut is saying one thing and the matrix convinces you of something else. Because so, I do everything by my gut. Like, I would have such a hard time going against my gut, but you have to when you're doing what you do.
So there was a company that we just closed on in July, right before the 4th of July, and my gut kept pulling me back. It kept holding me back. It just kept making me nervous. And I was having a hard time sort of progressing in diligence. And then when I sat down and did the rubric, I realized that the score was much higher than some of my very strong companies that are performing really well. And so I really started to unpack why was I feeling anxious? Mm-hmm. And I think I was feeling anxious because it's a clinical space that we had never invested in. And it's an up and coming space. It's huge space. And honestly, the company, I was sort of just nervous because I was nervous. I wasn't nervous because there was any reason for me to be nervous. And actually, I was lucky. I was able to invest in the company at a really strong, you know, very attractive valuation, mm-hmm. with much more risk sort of taken out of the equation than normal, just because of the sort of parameters of that deal and the technology and, you know, the way I was able to get into it. So I was able to kind of rethink it, and I still sat on it because, again, when you have that gut, what I realized, it wasn't that it was nagging me because something was wrong. It was nagging me because I was trying a new clinical space. And I said, I finally got myself comfortable, I guess, courageous enough to say, no, we're going to try a new clinical space. And it's in a neurotech space. And so We'll see. Maybe you should check in with me in a couple of years.
I will. I know. We can revisit. Is this on your website, or is this public yet, this one?
It's not public yet. It'll be on our website soon. Yeah.
Second thing I want to unpack was earlier on you said how you're, as a VC, you're sort of the coach of a team. Mm-hmm. And then you talked about follow-ons and using this of whether or not you commit to a follow-on or not. And I always just assume, like, if you're in on the Series A, obviously you have to review things for Series B, but your inclination is going to be to support your team. You've already kind of picked this team. What is that process like when you're looking at follow-ons? And how, you know, I don't know, how often do you, how much scrutiny do you give a company when it's asking for a second round of capital or a third round of capital? And do you, how often do you say, it's been fun, but, you know, I'm not seeing this anymore?
I have done it.
Yeah.
I've done the, it's been fun, I'm not doing this anymore.
Yeah.
That tends to happen when the companies we get in very early.
Yeah.
So I can cut my losses sooner rather than later.
Sure.
Normally I would say that that happens less. You know, I know there are some funds that they invest early and then they never invest again. That is not our model. We tend to really stick it out with our companies. But regardless, I think it is a great exercise at the time of the follow-on investment to really take stock of what has the company done well, what is the company needing to work on, where are we, you know, compared to where we thought we were going to be. Normally, that stuff is I mean, I'm either on the board or taking a board observer seat, so I normally can answer all those things even before, well before we're doing a next fundraise, but we still do the work because I think it's always really important to understand how on track is the company, how on track is the team versus how off track are they, frankly. And so we take our follow-ons really seriously. We don't just commit. We really do. We don't do the primary research again or anything like that, but we look at our old investment report. We're constantly, even after every board meeting, we have a matrix with, you know, the main, you know, clinical, regulatory, product development that we're filling out and tracking. We have monthly reports that we send to our investors about how each company is doing. So we're regularly maintaining it, but this is a great milestone for the fund to really take stock of how is the company doing.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes, many times, actually, if we think the company's really doing well, we will do more than our pro rata. So that's an interesting discussion when that happens, when we think the company is really excelling and we think the company is still at a good valuation, we will do a super sort of majority investment, which doesn't always happen. I think those are your rare stellar cases. But it does provide the opportunity of that analysis to happen.
Interesting. Before we get into more of your strategy, just how big is your you have an evergreen fund? Do you have a size that you share? I just want to give people.
It's about $100 million.
$100 million. Okay, great. And how many investments do you typically make in a year?
Ooh,
I'm sure it varies. New investments.
One to three.
Okay. Okay. So you give them a lot of attention, a lot of time and
yes.
Yeah. So let's focus on your preference and your desire to invest in executives from underrepresented populations within MedTech. How do we define that? I'm clearly kind of trying to find the words to use. When you say that, are you thinking women? Are you thinking of people of color? Are you thinking both? How do you define that population?
Women and people of color.
Okay.
Both. Right.
So how is that fit into your strategy? You're clearly an entity that is designed to return revenue. And I'm guessing you're doing this partly because it's the right thing to do, but partly because you see an opportunity there, an economic opportunity there. Mm-hmm. Help me understand both those aspects of your strategy.
Well, I mean, I'm a female and I'm a person of color. So it's sort of a natural inclination for me. I went to Wellesley, as you know. I mean, at Harvard, women are also in the minority there. And so it's always been important to lift up the sort of minority voice in my life. I think that's always been something that's just been part of my DNA, I guess. And so I just sort of gravitated towards that. No, I'm not like other funds that have like a mandate. Like I know there are some funds that are just only female founders. Mm-hmm. We don't have that mandate because I think it's good to have flexibility, especially when you're trying to talk about maximizing returns. However, I think you can work hard at it. And I think if there are definitely times when teams have pitched me and there's no sense of diversity that's pitching me. I don't see any diversity on their management team, even in their advisors. I will call them out on it. Mm-hmm. And I think you have to say something because it just makes economic sense to have diverse voices at the table. I mean, everybody knows that, right? Diverse perspectives end up with better outcomes. And that's all we're looking for, right? We're all looking for economic sort of fruitfulness and productivity. So we need to have diverse voices at the table. I think you've not done a good enough job as a leader if you haven't built a diverse team, period. Mm-hmm. And I'm not sure I want to invest in that then.
No, it's great.
I want to invest in the best team. So if you want to invest in the best teams, you're investing in the most diverse teams.
So are people coming to you with opportunities? Are you out aggressively looking for those situations? How do these deals come together?
So between myself and our principal, we cover many, 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 many events throughout the year where mm-hmm. we're sort of out there getting exposed to companies. I do office hours at the iLab. I'm always very pleased to see at the iLab lots and lots of diverse founders. So that's fabulous. I love it. And maybe I just attract the diverse founders, who knows, but I love seeing that. But we do lots of events. So that's a lot of deal sourcing. But honestly, I would say that the most compelling way, if I look at now the history of the last 2-3 years, the deals we've done, it's been word of mouth. You know, another entrepreneur has, like one of our CEOs has connected me to somebody and, you know, we went into diligence and it worked out. Or another one of our entrepreneurs exited and now is looking, you know, is doing the next thing. And, you know, that's really how some of the best deals have come to us, mm-hmm. is sort of more of an organic network way. And I guess I know that that may perpetuate certain types of founders getting money or more traditional founders getting money. But because my network is already based of females and people of color, I'm able to continue to invest in those types of people and mm-hmm. that, you know, those diverse teams. So I guess it just sort of, because I've been focusing on that since the genesis or the inception of the fund, I'm able to keep building on that.
Do you see this? Do you see us being at a point where we'll see more people of color and women in leadership? Because just speaking from my perspective as someone who hosts a podcast, and if you look at my podcast page, you know, I'd like it to be more diverse than it is, or have a conference that I've tried to recruit speakers that represent the entire population. I also, though, need to get people who are in leadership and who speak with authority and have experience. And it's great when I can find both. Unfortunately, I find it tilting me in one direction. And I'm hopeful that 10 years from now, someone in my position won't be having as much trouble as I do creating agendas, I think, that represent the population as a whole. So do you see things improving? Do you see, does this cadre of young people coming up give you hope?
Oh boy, that pause was not good. Maybe we should edit that pause. Maybe it's natural. I am hopeful because I think that there are definitely founders and investors that don't look like, you know, they did 10, 15 years ago. Are there enough? Is there enough diversity in the market? We're not even close. We're not even close to enough diversity, which is why I feel like there was that long pause. There's just too few companies. And I don't know if I think that you have the, if you look at all the funds that are focusing on investing in females or, you know, people of color, I would really classify them as smaller emerging funds. Mm-hmm. And so while there's a proliferation of those type of funds, I don't think that they have enough dollars to move the market dramatically. And even in the large VC shops, I think the statistics show that still the majority of the decision makers are actually not women or not people of color. So while they may be employed by the firm, they're not the decision maker. And so if they're not the decision maker, they're probably not moving the market. Mm-hmm. If you have a bunch of smaller emerging funds that are sort of focusing on this as a mandate, that isn't enough dollars to move the market. What you really need is the larger funds to take a significant stance and earmark significant money to changing how they invest and, frankly, making mandates about how much they invest in females and how much they invest in people of color. Mm-hmm. They also probably, if you look on the, I mean, there's that's, and then if you look on the LP side, the LPs have to probably mandate the large, huge LPs have to mandate the large firms that they're investing in saying, we need your portfolio to have this many females in it. We need your portfolio to have this many people of color in it, you know, in terms of leadership roles. Those are some serious systemic changes that we need to do. And I think that our markets aren't necessarily set up to support such sort of dictations around what the expectations are and how we invest our dollars. So that's why I guess it's a sort of I feel like we've made a lot, we've made progress, you know, based on what was happening in the 80s or the 90s. But I don't think that we're moving, in the pace that perhaps other industries are moving in. Hmm. I think we're really lagging still.
That's interesting. I mean, if I were to go by like really young folks, like we had people volunteer, students at BU volunteer to help with the Device Talks Boston conference, I'd say if not all but a few were either women or people of color. I've been, so I think maybe at the college level, the really new recruit, I think those numbers are, I think there's going to be such an influx of young women and young people of color coming to the sector that I hope that we can't help but see a change 10 or 20 years from now, but we can't wait for that to happen, obviously. And you're right about the need for systemic changes as well. And I don't mean to make you representative of an entire societal problem that we have, but just to wrap up, I mean, how has that strategy helped you as a VC firm? Do you feel that you're seeing deals that others have missed? Do you feel that, and I feel you're right about the diversity of a team. I think that's a really important thing to have as well. Do you feel making that a priority has helped you get better deals and that other VC firms, if they're not doing that, perhaps are missing out on investment opportunities, really great return opportunities?
I mean, I think just being somebody different at the table as an investor allows me to have I have a different approach when I'm talking to my entrepreneurs. Even when I'm doing diligence, I have different way of asking questions, different questions that I ask. And I think that always lends to a different experience for the entrepreneur versus sort of what they're regularly used to experiencing. And I think sometimes that allows for a richer experience. I think just personally, as you may have gathered, we don't invest in tons and tons of deals. So when I'm investing or doing diligence on a deal, you are dealing with me. Mm-hmm. You are with me. I am giving you attention. You are, you know, I am laser focused on the deal and the opportunity. And I think that your entrepreneur eventually senses that and they respond to that. And I think, as I was saying, in terms of word of mouth only works if the person you have a relationship with has a good experience with you, and then they refer other people to you because they feel like that's a promising sort of relationship or whatever, you're worth the introduction. So I think it's less about me or me in terms of as a female or me as a person of color, but more me as my approach to investing and sort of how much I give to each of my investments. They're not just one of many investments. They are the CEO, the deal for me. Mm-hmm. And every single, it doesn't really even matter how many dollars, I'm fully in it. And I think that's, I would assume that's sort of what they're sensing.
Excellent. Well, it's been, I really do appreciate the honesty, both about the problem that you're working to help, but also just the process of assessing deals. And I think people really do need insight on how investment opportunities are looked at, and every firm is different, but I think just this will help folks just understand the boxes that they need to check before they even reach out to you. And I just appreciate the honesty. It's been a really great conversation. Thanks for joining us on the podcast.
Thank you so much, Tom, for having me. It was a great opportunity. I love chatting with you guys, with you.
Well, that is a wrap. Thanks so much for joining us on this episode of the Device Talks Weekly Podcast. Once again, we hope you join us at Device Talks West. Use the code DTPOD, as in podcast, DTPOD25 to save 25% off the price of registration. It's going to be a fantastic 2 days. Just secured cooperation or a speaker, not cooperation. We just secured a speaker from Shockwave Medical. It should be a familiar face. Shockwave, of course, now part of Johnson & Johnson MedTech. So excited to have them on board as well. And we'll continue to add speakers probably over the next couple of weeks and can continue to confirm speakers. So keep an eye at west.devicetalks.com. It's a fluid agenda in terms of it's flowing upward. It's getting bigger and it's getting better, and you should be there. So go to west.devicetalks.com to register and use the code DTPOD25 to save yourself some money. Thanks for listening to this podcast. If you are anxious about missing podcasts, you should certainly subscribe or follow our Device Talks podcast network. That way you won't miss a future episode of Device Talks Weekly, Structural Heart Talks, which we launched last week, Ortho Innovation Talks, which I mentioned earlier in the podcast. We have our new Neuro Innovation Talks podcast that's coming out. Should be out in a week and a half. So, and we're working on much, 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 much more. So just save yourself the anxiety and just follow or like or subscribe to the Device Talks podcast network so you won't miss anything. You won't miss anything. You won't have to worry about it. We'll send it right to you. It'll be like getting packages from Amazon that you didn't even have to order. They'll just be sent directly to you. It'll be amazing, and you won't have to recycle any boxes at all. Promise. So please do that. And of course, also follow us on LinkedIn. I am Tom Salemi. Chris Newmarker is the executive editor of Mass Device. Kayleen Brown is our managing editor. You should connect with all of us as well as the rest of the Mass Device and medical design and outsourcing teams, and follow those publications on LinkedIn as well. But we really do enjoy being part of your MedTech conversations, and we'd like you to be part of ours as well. So please do follow us on LinkedIn. That's it. Join us for Device Talks Tuesdays. Coming Tuesday, we'll be back. We're going to be starting our fall season, and it should be a great conversation. Go to devicetalks.com to register for that. Once again, that's free, and you can watch it live or on demand. All right, folks. Thanks again for joining us on this episode of the Device Talks Weekly Podcast.